Hi, Mark. Thanks for joining me on the Founders Predicament podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. It's great.
So I'm here in Manhattan and you are in Long Island. Explain where you are again.
I'm in a town called Malvern. It's the town where Tony Danza from Who's the Boss grew up. It's about 15 minutes east of JFK Airport along the South Shore in Nassau County. So I'm about a mile from the bay.
Very nice. So when the weather gets warmer, presumably you're going to hit the beach.
Oh, absolutely. I already have a portable power station that I'm going to bring and turn my cabana into my oceanfront office.
Okay. I just realized I didn't send you the questions ahead of time, so I'm going to have to wing this. So tell me a little bit about your background. And let me introduce you first also as you're the founder of GearBrain, which is a website that aims to help people who have smart home technology make sure that the next piece of kit they buy works with everything else they've bought.
That's a very good description. Yeah. Yes. I start, after years of building several successful businesses and making a lot of people a lot of money, I decided to go out on my own and try to make money for myself. And I saw with IoT coming that no one was addressing the consumer. It was all industrial IoT. So I created a site, GearBrain, to simplify IoT for consumers. And we have, because interoperability was one of the major problems within IoT, and it still is. There's all these different wireless protocols. Nothing works. There's no standardization. They're trying to get it, but there'll never be one. It's going to be very challenging. So I recognize that you had to do more than just go out and create a website. So what I've done is I've taken GearBrain and morphed it into more of a marketplace. And what the marketplace is, I rolled up the content site with a Q&A platform and our patented IoT configurator, which we call a compatibility engine.
So we have time to get into that later, but let's talk about Mark before GearBrain. So are you from Long Island?
I grew up in New Jersey and went to school in New Jersey. And then I lived in the city. I got a job in the city and I was like, okay, I wasn't sure I was going to coach high school football or do something. And then I ended up getting a job at an ad agency and then like that and got a job in publishing. And then I worked for a number of publishing companies. And then I ended up working for the Sporting News, which was one of my favorite jobs of all times. And what ended up happening was the digital world came. I saw that and I got in early. And I ended up launching a number of successful businesses. My first one, though, was I worked for Juno, which was a very interesting,
Remind me about Juno again.
So Juno was one of the first online, it was an ISP service. It gave people disks, just like AOL gave disks, and you got a free email address. And what we did was we used that to identify people with computer modems so that we could upsell them ISP service. That was the model. But it was run by D.E. Shaw, a big investment bank in the city. And they were known to use technology to make money. And an interesting story is, they formed a committee at D.E. Shaw on like, okay, what businesses can we create that can help us, use computers and technology to make money? So one was a financial website. The other one was free email, identify people with free email, and then upsell them ISP Juno. And then the third one was online bookstore. And they decided to go with Juno because they didn't feel that, selling books online was a big market business. So the guy whose idea it was asked if he could take it out on his own. So they said, sure, go ahead. And he went cross country, went to Seattle, got some funding, and the rest is history. That was Amazon. It was Bezos. And so Juno, when I got there, we were kind of morphing away from the ISP and trying to sell online books because they were mad that they let Amazon go. So we could do the same thing. And it was just crazy. And we totally got off strategy. But by the time we got back on strategy, what hurt us was Net Zero. I don't know if you remember Net Zero. They came in and offering free ISP, you know, and they have they had a dial. If you used a certain amount, you'd get charged. So, but that point I left and went to work for, I worked for a company called Phone Free, which was basically Skype, right? Before Skype. But the problem was, is we had all this money and we spent it all on marketing, and there was only 25% broadband penetration in the household. And this was a household or consumer application. So we kind of missed the boat on, we spent the money we shouldn't have, but you know, on hindsight, that's what happens. And so
well, that was another example, because a lot of people I've spoken to so far on the podcast, a lot of people have come up with these great ideas. I mean, myself included. And basically you hit the market too early. So, so later we'll look back on timing. Let's look back on timing, but I just think that's really interesting. Yeah, we'll look back on timing. So, so what happened after? So after Juno, then you had
Juno. I went for Phone Free.
Yeah,
and I did that, and then I worked for we had a revamped after a year. We had to revamp the entire business because we went from being a consumer application to more of a B2B application. So I left because it was an ad supported model, right? On the consumer side. So we went away from that. And then I got hired by a guy, Bo Peabody, and Village Ventures had invested in this company called the StreetMail, which was an email provider, which eventually became got bought by Everyday Health. And it was the email engine behind Everyday Health, which was all those email newsletters that they used to send out to people. So I was working for them. Then I got recruited to go work for About. Now, About.com got bought by Prime Media. And I went in after a year of them owning it. My former boss, who I knew, ended up working. He hired me because he recognized that there was a, you know, we needed to restructure everything.
So let me interrupt you a second. So I remember About, or maybe it's still around, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's called Dotdash today.
Right. So, but what was the premise behind About? Because I never really used it. So forgive me.
That was the problem. So it was About was all these guides, right? They'd hire these subject matter experts, which today you could consider them influencers, right? It was like a big influencer network. But we provided them the website. We provided them the SEO tools, the marketing tools, the editorial, the CMS. We gave them everything, right? They just have to qualify and write content, right? And we'd show them how to operate these individual web pages. And there was like, so it was kind of like the combination of influencers and social media all in one. And it was all optimized for search, right? And there was like, when I got there, there was like 600. They got it down to about 400 and something. And then we built it back up. But when I got there, we were losing about $3 million a year. And when I left, after selling the company, you know, to the New York Times for $410 million, we actually were on a pace. We were doing 50, we're probably making, well, we were losing on 19, about 15 to 20 million. We were losing about 3 million a year. When I left, we were doing over 50 million at a 50% margin.
Oh, so you're making 25 million.
We're making a lot. That's why the Times bought us. We helped fund the payback to that Mexican investor when they needed funding, because this thing was, this was a very, very profitable. We turned this into a very, very profitable business.
So again, excuse my ignorance, but what did the Times end up doing with it?
They held on to it for a period of time, and then eventually they sold it to the people who really, really wanted it. It's IAC. You know, when we first, so IAC, Barry Diller's company, right? They renamed it Dotdash. But what was interesting is when we were putting up, Prime Media wanted to sell the company, right? Because they were done with the .com, and or actually it was KKR owned Prime Media, and they wanted to sell About. So what happened was, especially once MarketWatch had got bought by at the time, Wall Street Journal, they felt there'd be a good opportunity to sell about. So they put out feelers, and IAC was one, or actually it was Ask Jeeves who won.
I remember that.
Right? So Ask Jeeves was came in, and then they withdrew because they were selling their company to IAC, right? So we ended up, it was the Times the Times and AOL were bidding back and forth, and the Times won. So we go to the Times, and then I left, and then it continued on. It was $100 million. We launched, when I was there, we were starting to launch about China. We're expanding. It was a great business, a really, really good business, and very, very profitable. So then the Times sold it to IAC, and it was really the Ask Jeeves guys who wanted it. Because what was interesting is it was about.com, you know, so whenever you had any kind of listing, it was always the first because it was A, you know, everybody did alphabetical, A, B, it was perfect, versus Ask Jeeves. And even it was ask.com used to run all these spots, and people used to think it was us. It was great. We didn't have to do any marketing. So it ended up happening was we ended up, you know, they bought the company. I had since left. I got recruited after we had sold, and I worked with the Times for over a year. I got recruited by Jeff Arnold, the founder of WebMD, who had bought a site called How Stuff Works. And we took How Stuff Works in a year, and we ended up selling it for $250 million to Discovery. And what happened was we were able to get Discovery and A&E to bid in a bidding war, and it bid up the price. And of course I didn't want to go. So I was like, you guys take it. And, you know, I got it to where you got it, you know, where it was. They sold it for $250 million. And then senior management didn't go, which is fine. That normally happens. So I ended up, took some time off, and I got recruited. The VC who invested was part of Street Mail, right? Well, Peabody was making an investment, and he wanted me to go as part of the investment. And it was in a small little review site in Ogden, Utah, called Top 10 Reviews. And it was two guys. There's probably 15 people in the company. I was the first employee outside of Utah. We raised money, an A round. And then I came in and I built out the New York and built out, helped them build the company into the largest independent publisher of science and technology content in the world. In 4 years,
what's that called?
That was, eventually it was called, the final name was Perch. So it was Top 10 Reviews. We purchased the Imaginova websites. Imaginova was the company that what's his name from CNN, Lou Dobbs, was the, that was his company, space.com. He renamed it Imaginova, and it was space.com, live science, and a comic book site called Newsarama. And which is very interesting. I don't know why, but it was. So we ended up buying those, rolled and reformed, took Top 10 Reviews, and called the company now Tech Media Network. And actually, that name's actually pretty good now. Back then, it was bad because it was, networks was a negative connotation. You know, it was, people didn't want to be associated with ad networks. But when you think about TV networks today, Tech Media Network's not a bad one.
No. So anyway. Let me go back to, I had a question about How Stuff Works. Was that affiliated in any way with the books by that name?
Yeah, well, Marshall Brain was the guy out of North Carolina State University. Marshall was the one, I think he had some books and stuff, and he built the site up, and then Jeff came in and as an investor, and I think bought the property with Marshall. And then we moved it to Atlanta, and then we really built it, you know, up the ad revenue and really... we were doing some really interesting things. There was one interesting story is Nancy Dubek, who at the time was the general manager for History Channel, wanted to rename the TV show Modern Marvels How Stuff Works. But she wanted to own the name. I said, well, you got to go talk to that guy over there because he owns the name, you know. But we'd be more than happy. And by the way, he is talking to your competitor about the name. And at which point, that's what got the two of them to bid against each other.
Oh, I see. Which one was she? She was with Discovery.
She was general manager of History Channel. She's in charge of history. She went on to become the CEO of Vice.
Oh, right.
Yes, big, very, very well known.
Yeah. Vice didn't do so well, did they? Didn't they go under?
If I all those ones, they're starting, they're closing, they're restructuring. What happened was they all expanded it. But as you know, content, when we went from, you know, when programmatic started to emerge, which was about 2009, 2010, right? That's when you started, everybody started losing margin, especially publishers, because what was happening is agencies wanted to push all this towards automation because they could take it was easy for them to manage big budgets. Two, could be a revenue stream for them. So for us at the time, when I was at, you know, Tech Media Network, it was great because we used to get a ton of traffic from syndicating content to Yahoo, but we could never forecast that traffic. So you couldn't sell that inventory. When it came, you got what you got. So, but on a programmatic basis, you could pre-sell it, right? So it actually worked out well. But now what happened with, over time, what you're seeing with programmatic is it's eating into your margins as a publisher. You know, you're going to get, when you used to get $20 a thousand, now you're probably getting $5 or $6 a thousand. So that impacts a lot of your costs. And I think if you're overspending and you're not generating revenue, yeah, you got to cut. And that's what's happening. And now AI, everybody's scared to death on AI because generative AI could create content, but we've learned a lot about that. It's you're going to get hurt. If you try to rely on AI to create your content for your site, you're in trouble. There's things you're going to have to do because Google's going to penalize you, and you're going to have to learn how to use AI along with your existing staff. You're going to probably restructure your staff and to have more editors and more subject matter experts that could work with AI where it creates it, but you tell it what to create, right?
Right, and also you moderate. You moderate the output. I think we discussed, we had a call last week, right? I told you about my tax fiasco where I asked, I think it was ChatGPT, where to send my New York State corporate tax return, and it gave me the wrong address. So as we know, it's really not infallible. It needs careful monitoring and a bit of common sense, which I obviously was lacking that week when I sent in my tax returns to the wrong place. But yeah.
Yeah, and that's you know, what we've learned is it's all about the prompt, what you tell it and how you tell it. The second thing, where does it go to get that data?
Right.
And the third thing is, okay, what the output is, how valid is it?
Yeah, you know, right.
Has it been audited? Has it not? And we're working with a company or an organization we just joined called C2PA. It's an association that is helping to monitor for content creators, monitor usage of their data, their articles, their images, and stuff to protect them. Because, you know, data governance is going to become very, very important as AI becomes more prevalent in the marketplace.
Right. Okay. So, we were last at top 10.
So I was at top 10. We turned that into, eventually that we started purchasing companies. Now that we rolled up, and I'll tell you an interesting story, was I bet my VC friend that we were, with the purchase of the Imaginova sites, we could generate, you know, $75,000 more a month in revenue. All right. And I bet him that. And he said, okay, you're on. And I ended up losing the bet. And the reason was it wasn't $75,000 a month. It was over $100,000 a month in revenue, newfound revenue.
So what did you do exactly?
All I did was I helped monetize the page and improve user experience. We looked at the page. And I knew because I had run a business like AdSense when I was at About. We had a division at About called Sprinks, which we sold to Google, who did offer us pre-IPO stock. And we said, no, we'll take the cash, that's a whole nother story. But so I know about contextual links. I knew their page and they were really good content. So what we did is we added certain little widgets to the page that generated over 100, and based on the traffic these sites were generating, right, and also had a high domain authority. It helped impact our existing site. It raised the level of awareness in our rankings. And the combination of all of them with these new widgets, everything, generated an additional $100,000 a month of revenue.
Wow, that's great.
So it's just understanding, and that's just from experience and knowing how to monetize a page. And now people are going so crazy. I mean, there's so many ads and pop-ups. I don't know how I get frustrated. You know, you can't do it.
Yeah. Android offers View Simplified Page. Now, not all sites are compatible with that, but I often, usually, there's a few exceptions. I think Forbes is not too bad. A couple of websites are not too bad. They're not so intrusive with the ads that you can't actually read the content. But if I get the option to view a simplified page, generally I pick that, because what that does is it sucks all the text out and whatever images it can scrape and then presents it to you in a very simplified way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I find it incredibly frustrating, particularly if I've got a phone with a low battery, to be inundated with all these video ads. And I know it's just trashing my battery. I can't stomach that.
So basically we started buying up, we started doing a roll up, right? In the science and technology space. Now that we're the largest independent publisher, we purchased sites like Best of Media, which was Tom's Guide, Tom's Hardware. We purchased laptopmag.com. We purchased, I left when we were in the process of doing Buyer Zone, which is, you know, we were talking to them while I was there, and I told them, look, we can't have any more discussions till we complete this existing acquisition, which was Best of Media, you know, and that put us on the international map. We expanded internationally, opened up an office in London, and they had offices in France. So, we started to become more of an international, you know, science and technology publisher. Then I left, because they had new management come in and I wanted to do my own thing. That's when I saw, you know, I did a short stint while I was trying to think what to do. I helped out a friend of mine, 12fold, which was a company. I did it for a year, but then I really wanted to dig into, I really wanted to do my own business. So
what does 12fold do?
12fold was an ad stack, a platform that did, it was programmatic. It was, I guess you could say it was a SSP in a way. But what they did is you would buy contextual. You would buy impressions that we would know the mindset of the consumer. So in other words, you were looking to reach buyers of TVs, let's say, right? So your ads would only appear on pages that were designed where the person was in the mindset to buy a TV. So it could be a TV review, talking about TV, what you need to buy, how, you know, and everything like that. So we were able to, you know, review and see on all the ad exchanges, all the pages. And then based on those pages, we would buy for advertisers, the ones that fit the mindset of the consumer they were trying to buy.
Can't you do that?
Cookieless ad targeting.
Right. So can't you do that with Facebook and
this is before that all came out. Yeah.
Oh, so what year are we talking about?
This is about 2014, early 15.
Okay. So what about DoubleClick? You couldn't do that with DoubleClick at that point, or?
You really could, not on the exchanges. You know, you could, it was very, and it's very scientific. There was a lot of, you know, technology, a lot of brain power behind that. Yeah. And they're still in business today. I forget the name of the company. They're doing well because it was designed for a cookie-less environment, right?
A cookie-less environment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, if cookies go away, how do I know that this, you know, this is a page of content, so therefore I could target, you know, buyers.
I see. Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, so, it was an interesting business. But then I said, you know what? I'm going to do my own thing. And then I talked to some friends and I left. And I spent the summer thinking, writing the business plan, coming up with the thing. And then I joined Gramercy Labs, my buddy's incubator. And we launched GearBrain, kind of beta in October, November, and then in January of 2016 is when we launched the site, gearbrain.com.
Excellent. So what problem are you solving? I mean, we've touched on it earlier, but if you go a little bit, so what sure. problem is GearBrain solving, and who's going to use it?
We solve two problems. The first problem is the consumer, right? It's in we solve the problem of interoperability, right? We help them find, buy, and connect any smart device. And the reason because interoperability is a big issue when all these connected devices with IoT, they all work on different wireless protocols, and people want unified control. They want simplicity, right? And they want to be able to bring a device home and have it work directly with the devices they have. And nobody was addressing the consumer. So that's the one problem we have on the consumer side. And think about it. They have to tell us what devices they have so that we can show them what works with what, right? The second problem we solve is for the manufacturers, retailers, and installers. We help them simplify the selling, the integration and management of all these devices with a white label solution or just our data alone, where we can help them learn what devices people have in their house, because that's what everybody wants to know. That's what Google wants to know, what Apple wants to know, that's what Microsoft wants to know, you know, Amazon wants. They want to know what you have in your house or what's important to you so they can upsell you and sell you more crap. That's really what it comes down to. You know, you can't make it any simpler than that, right? So we use the consumer problem of helping them understand what works with what and translate that into data that we can help the manufacturers understand what people have in their house so they can upsell them products and services. And the way we do this is through this marketplace now where we rolled everything up, all right? And the platform, we have a patent for a IoT configurator, which is the ability for a user to search for compatibility of two or more devices across a single ecosystem. Now, it works across any category, right? We've picked smart home just because there's a glaring need right now.
So just give me an example of three devices that somebody could, so someone can understand what you're solving.
So I have smart lights. I have a home security system.
Okay.
All right. I want now to get a video doorbell for my home security system. And I also want the lights because I don't want to have three different apps. I want all the apps to work together. You tell us the home security system you have. You tell us the lights you have. All right. And how you're going to control it. Do you want to control with the lights or you want to control with home security? Most likely home security, because that's the app you're going to use every day to arm and disarm your service. All right. And then we'll show you all the platform. We'll show you all the video doorbells that are compatible with that home security system. And then we'll show you where you could buy it. We could show you how to install it. We can give you all the owner's manual setup guides. We could also show you how-to videos, all the links to customer support, warranties. It's all there on this product page, right? So that's one way, right? Other ways could be where, okay, I want to add, I have lights, I have locks, door locks, but I want a thermostat. But I want it all working together, right? Okay, fine. Tell us, you know, what you have, and then we'll show you all the thermostats that are compatible. And the same thing, right? And now, so we've developed this database, almost 5,000 smart devices, that we have all this product information, data, manuals, and everything rolled up into a database. We're in the process right now of building out a virtual assistant using AI, right? That'll allow the user to ask questions. You don't even have to go to the platform. You can just ask it a question saying, and it might come back to you and say, it will start to teach you, because we're teaching it, what questions to tell the consumer to ask themselves before they make a purchase. Because right now, a lot of people don't know where to start. A lot of people don't know what to ask, right? So we're using AI to teach them, or we're teaching our platform and then using the AI to teach the consumer what questions to ask, what to do, and where to buy, and do everything all along the journey.
So from if you say this A is compatible with B, or you're using A and B, so you use C, do you actually have experience doing that, or are you basing that on the spec sheet that the manufacturer provides you with?
Both. Remember now, we have this content site. Our content site does product reviews, and our product reviews are only done if the manufacturer sends us a product, right? And then when we get the product, we test it, and we pretty much know what works with what, you know, because we test it and we can see it. And so it's now taking, you know, that information, right, and applying it to the database, applying it to articles and everything, and feeding it all into an AI. Because right now, the problem with AI is you never know what it's going to go after. But as we talked earlier about the prompt, if you tell it what to do and how you tell it, right, we already know what works with what and everything. So we're going to be able to teach the AI to teach the consumer what to do using our data, because we know our data is accurate, because the manufacturers are the ones, we're taking their data, and we use the content site to pull it in.
I have a follow-up question regarding the ABC thing. Uh-huh. As manufacturers keep adding new products and the 5,000 becomes 10,000, then the number of permutations and combinations
will increase,
skyrockets. Huh? So how are you going to account for that? And at what point do you think there will be like a USB consortium equivalent for IoT? two completely different questions. Let's go to the first one first, which is,
we're already there. We have probably over 1 million different combinations on what we already have, right? Because you think about it, right? I mean, there's probably almost 2,000 products within our platform, right, that work with Alexa or Google or whatever, right? And when you start to think about Matter, and you start to think about, okay, you know, this person, you know, has in their house Amazon and Google, right? And it's like, okay, how do you want to control it? Do you want to control it with one or the other? And then based on that and how Matter works, right, it could be compatible, but we're going to tell it to say, all right, look, does A, B, you want A, B, and C all to work together? Well, A and B can work together. A and C can work together. But if you want all three together, you're going to have use C as the controller, because that's the only combination that works. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's where the AI comes in. And that's where actually, when we start to go further down the road, that's where deep learning comes in. If you look at AI, like right now we're dealing with it's the back end, that deep learning that is really going to, that's when the engine starts doing things on its own. You know, it starts learning and it has an intuitive instinct to say, okay, yeah, I'm going to do this because this is what Ray wants to do. You know, because this is what he normally does, right? Now, a lot of this will probably be prompts where, hey, I'm going to go do this. Is that okay, Ray? You know, we'll start asking you for permission, you know, because that's probably some of the protocols that are going to be put in place. But at the end of the day, you know, we're teaching it, but we're only teaching our data. We're not sharing our data, even though the engines could probably get the platform, you know, data. They don't know how to use it, right? And that's where the prompts come in, where we know how to use it.
Okay, interesting. So that's what you're, so how many views are you getting a month? What would you want to get to? Or, you know, you don't have to share that if you don't want to, but.
Anyway, it depends on the time of year, right? Holiday season, everybody's out there looking to buy stuff. We do really well. It could be over 100,000 monthly. Right now it's 50 to 60,000, you know, it's a global, you know, it's not, but we're focused. We have, and that's totally organic. We're not spending a dime on marketing. It's word of mouth. And it's usually 80 to 90% of the audience is new every month, which makes sense because people are coming in, they're looking to buy. Once they buy, they leave. You know, they don't come back until they're ready to buy, or they're looking to ask a question, right? And that's pretty much on the norm with ours. But our focus, again, we're using the website content marketing, you know, as we're using our website as a way to pull in product data and generate awareness. It's our marketing spend, right? Mm-hmm. The platform is our technology, right? It's our IP. Yeah. And the licensing of this, whether it's in the form of a white label solution or it's in the form of just doing virtual assistants that we license to manufacturers, retailers, and installers to help them save money on customer service, fielding compatibility calls. Or manufacturers can build it into their site to help the user guide them to find the right product that they want to buy, right? Same with retailers. This assistant could be, you know, and there is another one that's popping up where there's a development taking place in credit card processing. I don't know how much you know about credit card processing.
A little bit.
All right. So you got PayPal. PayPal announces smart receipts, right? So you got smart receipts, which is they're using AI in the cart to tell, let their customers, as he's checking out a product, hey, these other products are on sale and they're relevant to what you're doing or what you bought. You know, do you want to add these to your cart, right? That's a service they're going to add to their customers, right? They got to get product data somewhere. And that's where we come in, because that's where patent comes in, where we can say, oh, that product works with these products, you can list these products, oh, which of those products are on sale here, all the ones that are on sale, blah blah blah. We could do all that within milliseconds.
Okay, so let me ask you slightly different, well, I'll let me ask you the simple question, the obvious question first. So what the most popular home devices, IoT, and what the most popular combinations?
Oh, I would say the most popular are lights. Lights are probably the most popular. Those are the easiest. Lights and plugs, because they're the easiest. I can't tell you how many people Christmas during the holidays said, hey, you got a smart plug? I want to plug my lights for my tree or my wreath in a plug. All right. You know, they don't want to deal with those outdoor timers or whatever. Right. So those are very popular. Cameras, video doorbells are pretty big. Smart locks. And then home security to a certain extent, you know, not everybody has a house, you know, people rent, there's limitations and stuff. And then thermostats are pretty big. Those are the six that are probably most popular, right? Mm-hmm. Now you could start getting into really, you know, in some of these cameras, I've seen everything from, you know, these power over Ethernet cameras to, indoor outdoor cameras, pan and tilt cameras, you know, there's all these different NVRs, DVRs, all that. It can get very complicated, right? And but the most popular, and when you think of a house, it's lights, locks, thermostats, video doorbells, home security systems, and then some cameras, some simple cameras, you know, they can put up.
Okay. You know. So that makes a lot of sense. And then let's go to what I think is the most interesting thing that we talked about last week was your exit strategy. So I was asking you about your exit strategy and you said, well, I don't necessarily want to exit, I think. And then you also discussed ways of keeping the ball rolling, keeping people incentivized, even though there's no IPO or whatever on the horizon. So would you like to talk about that a little bit?
So there's, you know, everybody wants to know your exit strategy, right? So for me, you know, if I build a very, very, and I plan to build a very, very successful, profitable business, why should I sell? Because I'm getting older. You know, I have family and everything. And so, but I get it when you take institutional or other people's money, they're going to want a return. You know, you might want to stay, but that's great, but they want their money or they want the return on their investment. So how do you give them a return on investment? Well, there's a couple ways you could do it. One, you could sell a company. You could either go public, or my idea, which is based on my experience when I worked with Cox Enterprises, the big media company out of Atlanta, they had a phantom stock program. This is one of the first times I learned about it. And what it was is, you know, they would pay their key employees, you know, they would give them a stock grant. right? It would be a cash amount of a certain amount of money based on your salary and experience and level. And then over a period of time, you know, I think it was a 4-year period, that investment, that stock, that grant, let's call it a grant, would vest almost double. So, and at which point you could take it out, right? And it's yours. It would be like a bonus. And they would pay the bonus every 2 years. So think about it. If you join a company, and then after the first year, they enter you into this plan, right? In 4 years. So in the fifth year of your company, every other year now, you're going to get on top of your salary and your bonus, you're going to get this other big check. Right. Because it's like their stock and it's, you know, they're paying them, I know some guys are making serious cash off of this. And it's a way where they get to a point where, all right, I'm going to leave the company. Well, if I leave the company, I'm going to lose out on the payment next month or next year. And it could be a couple hundred grand, could be a million, depending on what level you're at. So it's like, is it really? And new employer ain't going to reimburse you for that, you know, plus you have all this other stock, all these other grants that you've earned that are start to come as well, because you get it every year, every 2 years you get a grant, you know, so you start to think about that, you know. And I said to myself, you know what, that's not a bad way to do it. Whereas, you know, my plan is to, you know, as we get profitable, share the profits with the employees and our investors and pay and treat it like a phantom stock program. Right. Just like if we went public, your stock would be worth X. OK, you're going to get a check for X, you know, and that's the your percentage of the profits. And then you could use that to pay down, you know, the money or however you want to do it. But you still have equity in the company, you know, but it's a way to pay off some of their or them to give to their investors or however they feel, you know, they want to use the money.
So this only works if there's positive cash flow, right? This only works in the case, because a lot of companies do IPOs pre-revenue, if you will, like they're making not pre-revenue, but pre-profit. Certainly lots of companies have in the tech space have gone public or sold before they've made a dime.
So yeah, and that's,
this wouldn't work under that scenario, right?
No, because a lot of those guys took money, you know, they took a lot of money because it was always like grow, right? And some of it was fake growth, you know? I mean, and some of it was real. Like, look at right now. It's hard for some people. You know, how many companies are going public? Tech companies. Not many, you know? And you think about the ad tech space, where there is billions of dollars in the ad tech space. You don't see any of those going public. And there's a lot of money, a lot of VC money tied up in there. You know, so I think for us, it's the exit is there's always an exit. It's, you know, hey, I'm not dumb. You know, someone says, Mark, here's X amount of dollars, you know, and it's a significant, you know, number. Of course I'd sell, you know, but I think I'm not out there looking to sell. I'm looking to, if anything, we're looking for a strategic partner to help us grow. Right. And as we grow, you know, having, you know, paying, you know, giving our employees incentive where they actually get a piece of the profits is something that I think is unique and not many companies do.
Right. No, I think that's a really interesting strategy.
And the other thing too, Ray, sorry to interrupt. The other thing too is you got to remember these young people today, they don't care about stock options. They want cash. So if you want to hire good young people, good developers or everything like that, you got to remember that these guys want cash. They want them. They want immediate gratification. They don't want to wait 5 years for a stock to mature and then they, you know, get out. They want. So that's another way. You know, this program would solve that problem for you.
Yeah. Okay. Great. So I think we covered everything that was on the original agenda. Is there anything else, like, well, can you think of advice you'd give to founders today? You know, people a bit younger than us who are just getting, you know, they're out of college or out of high school in some cases, and they really have the chops, they have the technical chops or the design chops or the, you know, strategic chops to do something. What would you say to them? What would you say, let's say, what to avoid, and what to embrace?
I would say don't necessarily hire your friends. Hire the best people for the job, right? That would be one thing, because, you know, it's, you want to make sure you're hiring people who are better than you or smarter than you. And I know a lot of young people are threatened by that, right? But that's how you're going to get ahead, because they're going to bring a level of expertise that you don't have that's going to help you, you can learn from. So hire people you can learn from to do the job that you need to do. The other thing is, when it comes to equity, don't give everybody equity, right? You know, hold on to the equity and only give it to the people who are actually contributing, right? A lot of founders make mistakes in the beginning and give away founder shares to people who say they're going to help and they end up not helping them, right? That's a big problem. And then your cap table's all out of whack, because now you've given all these shares away, and when you really need them and you want to give it to someone who is deserving, they're not there, right? The other thing too, it's a lonely business. You got to remember, it's, you know, it's you. When you have something to do, turn around, there's nobody there, you got to do it. So, but that's how you learn the business, you know, and you know that feeling. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's actually one of the nice things about this podcast, is it gives me a sense of community, you know, reaching out there and getting some feedback. So that's great. And to that end, well, so thank you, Mark. This has been so, I'm really excited actually that we had this conversation. You've shed light on so many things that I had no clue about. And I've been in this business a long time. Obviously, I've been doing the wrong things, but
we're doing well. Well, Ray, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. You know, sure. I always love talking to people.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining me on The Founder's Predicament.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you, sir. Be good.
Bye-bye.